In the last 2 weeks, Alabama, Missouri, and Georgia passed laws that would effectively take away a woman's right to choose to obtain an abortion. For example, Alabama will criminalize the performance of an abortion by a doctor with penalties up to 99 years in prison without any exceptions for rape or incest. Now that the composition of the Supreme Court has changed, how will women's reproductive rights be undermined or curtailed? How will the legal battle play out, and what can be done to counteract this trend? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic, a weekly in-depth look at a topic that helps us understand the week's news. My name is Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a CNN legal analyst. And I'm joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, a WGN radio host who will join us regularly on this podcast. Well, Patty, I have to say I didn't realize this week was going to be such a major week for reproductive rights. I mean, there was just an absolute assault on reproductive rights this week from multiple states, and I didn't see it coming.
Well, and that's, I think, part of the problem is that a lot of people were saying, oh, they're never going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And they told a lot of people like me, oh, just relax, you're overreacting, for years, when states like Texas were including restrictions when it came to how wide the doors could be, or your visitation rights as a doctor at a hospital, you had to have certain sort of requirements. They have been, in states across the country, peeling back access to abortion. And it is unfathomable to me that we are at this point now where we're having these conversations, because I remember when President Obama was in office, people would tell me, oh, you know, I don't care how many abortions a woman has as long as I don't have to pay for them. You can have 1,000. I mean, just ridiculous language. Uh-huh. And sort of poo-pooing anybody who wanted to stand up and say, look, we need to make sure we hold the line on women's access to health. And that's what this is all about. It is not just about getting pregnant or keeping making a woman carry a pregnancy to term. This is about, a lot of states now have these regulations in place. OBGYNs are not being filled because of the insurance rates, mm-hmm. because of the restrictions, all these things. Women's health, it's not just about abortion. This is about women's health in general, and it is going to be increasingly harder for women to take care of themselves and their families as we go forward in this if this is the way the country's going, especially for the red states.
Well, you know, throughout my career as a lawyer, I've seen a systematic effort to try to restrict reproductive rights, and it's been very effective, particularly in certain southern states and in middle west states like Oklahoma. There'll be, for example, only one facility in the entire state where someone can actually get an abortion, and so while you technically have the right, it can be so burdensome,
right,
that it's practically difficult or nearly impossible for a woman to get access to abortion. So I have to say, what I thought was going to happen once the composition of the court changed was that we would start seeing that right further chipped away. What's shocking to me is we have these extraordinarily sweeping laws that have been enacted in some of these states like Alabama that are just very, very extreme. They're just going to try to wipe it out entirely. And it almost reveals the end goal here in a way that I think a lot of conservative lawyers have been, you know, just trying to have restrictions around the edges and do it in a piecemeal fashion.
It's interesting you mention Oklahoma, because Oklahoma has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the country. Alabama actually has the second worst in the country. So we're talking about states, and that tends to be the truth across the board when it comes to the states that are most aggressive when it comes to restricting abortion access. They have high infant mortality rates. So it is not about life. The fact that they can continue to say every life is precious is not true. It's a fallacy, because it really is about controlling the future, the health of women. Because, by the way, getting pregnant, people act as though we get pregnant, we should just have the baby. It's as though you had sex, you asked for it, you knew the risks, you now have to carry this to term, the pregnancy to term. there are also health risks involved. And I wonder where lawyers stand on this, because preeclampsia, pregnancy, gestational diabetes, you can have infections when you are delivering. There are a lot of complications that can arise. So we are also asking women who, first of all, don't want, if it's a matter of want, right? Let's say it's in the first 10 weeks, the first 12 weeks, the first 16 weeks. They realize they cannot have a baby. They're not ready for it, whatever their reasons are. We are now saying not only do you have to commit to this life, you also have to put yourself at these health risks. So I'm curious about that as far as the legal aspect of it.
Yeah, and I think I want to bring in our guest and get into that with her, because frankly, this is an imposition to me. It's, you know, you talked a moment ago, Patty, about how this is about access to health care. To me, it's really about a woman's control over her own body, because the decision to have a child is a major life decision and has tremendous impact on someone's health and really on their body for the rest of their lives. And so, essentially, to restrict a woman's choices and to essentially force her to carry a baby to term is an extraordinary burden to place on a woman. And it's really a lack of control over her own destiny.
Which is, I would think, is antithetical to what conservatives seem to say they stand for, is the lack of freedom. And the idea that you are now somehow, you have to be an incubator. Why would any Republican say we're now going to have you have this baby for the state? That's essentially what it comes down to in some instances. I mean, many.
Now I'm going to bring in Caroline Fredrickson. She is the president of the American Constitution Society, which is really the largest organization of progressive lawyers in the United States. I am a member of that organization. And before that, she was the executive director of, general counsel of NARAL, which is one of the most important reproductive rights organizations. She also, before that, worked on the Hill for Senator Daschle. She was doing a lot of legislative work on reproductive rights. So really a fantastic person to speak with us about this subject. And thank you for joining us. I appreciate it, Caroline.
Oh, it's a total pleasure. I'm happy to be with you. I'm not happy about what we're talking about, though.
I have to ask, because Renato said before we even got started that he was surprised that this accelerated this way in the past week. Were you surprised? That I need to know that first.
Well, I think we saw, it's sort of like a snowball. I mean, we saw the beginnings of it. This has been the wish list for the anti-choice people. And I think they, getting Kavanaugh on the court really precipitated a lot of efforts. And, I'm not sure this is what, the overall Republican Party really wants to happen, the national party, but the activists in the states see their opening and they're off to the races. We've seen bills like this in the past. It's just these bills are actually moving and moving in several states. And so it's definitely is an acceleration, but it's not something that is unprecedented or unexpected, really.
So, Caroline, can you give us a background on the state of the law for reproductive rights? I think for a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with how the law is developed, particularly after, from Casey onward.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, I think, everybody knows the basics of Roe. It set up the trimester sort of analysis. And then the case known as Casey changed the standard of review to some extent and said that you could not put an undue burden on a woman's access to reproductive rights. And so that's been a challenge in many ways, because, I think many people who believe women should have their reproductive rights protected, have a very different vision of what an undue burden is than, say, others. And we've seen those cases sort of coming to the court. Not too long ago was the Whole Women's Health case, which made it very hard for women to get an abortion by putting new requirements on care centers and on doctors that was basically a backdoor way to eliminate access to abortion. So that's kind of where we are now. The Supreme Court said just a couple of years ago that those kinds of restrictions were still unconstitutional. But then Justice Kennedy left the court, and now we have Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh. I think we don't think they'll be in the same place.
Yeah, I'm what we had seen for a period of time, I felt like, was there was a lot of litigation in the Supreme Court over the, as you mentioned, the undue burden test, which is the case that she's talking about, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. It was in the early 90s decision that was kind of the seminal case since Roe versus Wade in reproductive rights. But since then, we've seen efforts, as you mentioned, to chip away reproductive rights and to effectively deny access, or to put, you know, to make access to reproductive health care more and more difficult. And I have to say, Caroline, I thought that was the strategy that we would be seeing in the years to come, that there would slowly ratchet up and chip away at women's reproductive rights, as opposed to going at it in one fell swoop. Do you think that this makes sense for them as a legal strategy? How do you see this playing out?
Well, I think they'll have multiple strategies. I mean, there's still going to be those efforts to revisit the whole women's health case. You know, what is the undue burden, and can we basically legislate abortion out of existence and not violate Roe and Casey? I think that'll still happen, right? The states aren't going to stop passing those bills, and those will go to the court. In the meantime, they're going to set an outer limit, But I think the danger in many ways is that, you know, we all, we kind of focus on the heartbeat bills, the total ban in Alabama, these other really outrageous pieces of legislation, and don't pay as much attention to the bills that are doing what they've been doing, you know, for many, many years, which is requiring doctors to have admitting privileges in the hospitals, and requiring reproductive care clinics to have all sorts of additional machinery, or, you know, wider hallways, or, you know, any number of different kind of regulatory efforts to make it, you know, impossible, really expensive to run a clinic, and therefore shutting the doors. We got to watch out for that, because that, you know, they're pursuing, you know, multiple strategies. You know, I think that Chief Justice Roberts is a very sly individual. And I think he has, you know, a recognition that, that it's wiser in many ways to do the back door, overturning of Roe than the front door. And so I think we'll probably see the court take one of those cases, and overturn their recent decision in Whole Women's Health, but not necessarily take the old Alabama case, but we'll see. I mean, I think it's just they don't see any downside to pursuing both strategies.
I know a lot of listeners have questions. And now, you know, we're talking about states' rights is what's come up a lot. Where does it essentially Roe v. Wade? You said that Casey leaves it up to the states to decide what's going to happen state by state. But people wonder, how does, you know, the legislation in one state, and if it's successful, affect neighboring states? Is there any
No. Well, that's not actually quite accurate. Casey didn't say the states, you know, wouldn't leave it up to the states. It said that it altered the Roe paradigm, you know, the trimester paradigm, by using this undue burden language, which is, you know, as I said, it's sort of vague and hard to administer. But states were still had to meet that standard. They could not impose undue burdens on women's reproductive care. That didn't mean that they couldn't pass different types of laws. You know, they've tried, you know, requiring women to get have to notify their husband or get permission from their husband, and there have been, you know, plenty of bills focused on young women. So they proceed along those lines, but it's a constitutional right that applies everywhere in the United States. And so it's not a states' rights issue. It's a constitutional law issue. If Roe were overturned, which is their goal, that finding would be that it is not, in fact, a constitutional right.
So one thing that I, you know, just to circle back to your the point you were making about pursuing two strategies at once. Essentially, what we might see then, Caroline, is the court not taking, for example, not granting cert or not taking the case challenging the Alabama law. That could get stricken down by a lower court and then not even make it to the Supreme Court, and people will let out a sigh of relief. And then in the background, there could be all of these efforts, for example, that would chip away at reproductive rights that might be less publicized and seem less dramatic, but may have a very substantial impact that would build over time.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. It'll be a multi-pronged strategy. You know, it's clever in many ways. I mean, they throw the most outrageous stuff out there, and those are clearly violate Roe. I mean, there's no question about it that those are unconstitutional laws. I mean, and that's what they want. I mean, they say explicitly, we want to bring this to the court. We want to overturn Roe. They still have their whole agenda of, the whole other set of bills that they've pushed in the past. That they continue to push. I mean, there's just any number of them that go after women's right to choose. And so I think they'll continue with those. And you're right, Renato. I think, that one of those is, the ones that are most likely to go up to the court. And then the court will say, we're not overturning Roe, but it really is not an undue burden on women to have to, even if there's no longer an abortion clinic in the state, because of the cost, they could go to the next state. And so it's not an undue burden. Or they'll say, we're not going to accept the factual basis that this is actually going to make it too expensive.
Does Georgia's bill include the restriction that women cannot cross state lines in order to get an abortion? That was my understanding.
Those are really interesting questions about whether those are enforceable and that the whole idea that the criminal law rides on the back of the woman to the other state where she does something that's perfectly legal. This has come up in the past with abortion laws, with juvenile, where there have been places where a juvenile young woman has to go and get a judicial waiver or and she goes to another state where it's legal for her not to have to do that. And comes back. And there were bills that were trying to criminalize that. I think, that's just not how our criminal law works. And so, the question is, I think, Renato, you've been the prosecutor. How does that really, how does that work? That something that's legal in one state, you do that in that state and then you get prosecuted in another state.
I mean, usually we do not prosecute people for doing something unless the impact of it, the effect of it's in the state that's being mentioned. In other words, if you, for example, are committing fraud, you cross state lines to commit fraud that happens to impact the prior state, or do some other activity, right? You're going across to you go to Colorado to traffic in marijuana, and then you're shipping it to a state that it's still illegal in, or something like that. So it's very unusual, and as I think you're alluding to also, Caroline, that aside from the fact that I think on its face there's going to be due process issues that are sort of baked into that, I would also say that. It also places an undue burden on a person's right to travel, which is part of the Constitution as well. We're supposed to be able to, go freely amongst the United States and be able to follow the laws of those states and not, not have that that burden placed on us. So I don't know. It strikes me as extraordinarily problematic. I doubt it's actually going to be enforced. I'm very skeptical of those laws ever becoming enforceable. But I think Caroline's kind of intuition about how the strategy is going to play out, I think, is the most likely. But I think what this highlights for us, a couple things. It just shows you the tremendous energy and fervor out there to get a Roe ultimately invalidated, in Casey invalidated, and have no, essentially devolve this to the states and have states permitted to completely destroy a woman's right to have access to an abortion. But also, I also have really started to see, and I, one of the things I find interesting, Caroline, is this movement towards, there's a sense that they're trying to ground this in some sort of science. Now they're saying, you know, what I've been seeing from law, Republican lawmakers is now we can keep premature births, babies alive at an earlier age. So this somehow means that we need to have a change in law. They're trying to ground it to some sort of science. I'm curious what your reaction is to that.
Well, that's been a policy or an effort by the anti-choice forces for a long time. Going to 6 weeks is really an incredible step, however, because nobody thinks that that a fetus could survive at 6 weeks. And the idea is there, they may say it has something to do with science, but in fact, most women wouldn't even know they're pregnant at that point in time. And so what it does is effectively outlaw abortion at any point in a pregnancy. So to say that there's some scientific basis is just, it's just another, sort of false talking point that they're pushing out there, which is, consistent with what they've done in the past. I think the whole effort is, it's clever in many ways because they're trying to get at this issue of sort of, making a fetus, making people in their minds think it's a fully grown child, as opposed to understanding, fetal development and so forth, and the issue of viability, which was, how Roe was structured, the issue of viability. Now, science, and medicine have meant that viability, is a little earlier now, but it's certainly not at 6 weeks. And the point of these laws is not to, to have a viable fetus be protected. It's to outlaw abortion.
Yeah, I think that I feel like we need to make sure people understand that at 6 weeks, a woman maybe hasn't even missed her cycle yet. So she wouldn't even be aware that there's something to be concerned about. I don't even know how to make this more accessible intellectually for people who don't know how this works. Do you, Caroline?
Well, exactly. No. I mean, it's just, women have the period, every month or so.
Exactly.
Some women are more regular than others and some women are not regular at all. And, so they have different cycles and they wouldn't necessarily assume much, had happened. And even if they were a little concerned, they wouldn't have any idea that they were definitely pregnant. It's just, it is really not about, anything to do with science. Though they slapped a label on it. It has everything to do with making it impossible for women to control their reproductive rights in this country. What gets caught up in this is certain forms of contraception, they've targeted IUDs and others, other types of contraception that work to prevent an egg from attaching to the uterus or others. And so this is really... I said to somebody that they mistook The Handmaid's Tale for a how-to manual. It's sort of a joke, but not really, right? This is really a really radical approach to controlling women's bodies.
I had some folks on Twitter get upset at my use of the phrase incubator. But no, basically the state is saying you must incubate this baby for us, and not even taking, a lot of folks just think, well, just, you knew the risks, you had sex, no one forced you unless you were, of course, attacked by incest or rape. I think that completely negates everything that we understand when it comes to, first of all, being human, for having relationships, right? And people are like, well, no one forced her to have sex. So now the consequences, you have to be forced by the state to have a baby. And that doesn't even include the risks that are involved, whether it's preeclampsia, diabetes, infections, all kinds of things. But apparently that's okay. I'm sorry. I'm a little fired up, Caroline.
No, well, I'm totally fired up too. And I think that's, it's all exactly right. This is an effort. I think I like the term. I mean, I don't like the term incubator, but I think that's essentially what it is. What's incredible here is that, not only are these states that don't want to expand Medicaid coverage, but we could talk about that for a while. Do they care about children really? But these are also, what are the penalties for a man who gets a woman pregnant? Will he have to pay child support? What are the you know, sort of unintended or intended consequences of giving a fetus legal personhood, either at conception, like in Alabama, or at 6 weeks, like in these other states? You know, is a woman a murderer? Because if she she has an abortion, uses mifepristol, the drug, you know, is she guilty of murder because the fetus has personhood status in that state? I mean, but, you know, but they're certainly not looking at the obligations of a man. And last time I checked, this is a two-part process.
Well, it's just interesting you mentioned that, too, because one of the listeners had a question about what are the states going to do with undocumented workers if the fertilized egg is then a citizen, because that was what Alabama says. They give them citizenship because they also are then tax exemptions, right? And what are they going to do in that sense? Is the fertilized egg a U.S. citizen then?
Well, right, exactly. And so, you know, there, you know, does it need to have a Social Security number? And if the mother's not documented, it seems like whether or not she goes to deliver her child elsewhere, that child should be a U.S. citizen. What is the census issues? Does that child need to be counted? You know, so there are lots of bizarre things that happen when you start assigning a legal status to, you know, a six-week fetus, that are, you know, I think not, it's not in at all something that they care very much about, right? Having a law that's actually, makes sense. Cause, I think this is, you know, just, it's just an effort to get something to the Supreme Court if they can, you know, and or an effort to distract from the bills that they hope will go to the court and will actually upheld serious restrictions on abortion. You know, as I said before, I think it's sort of, it's not a distraction because these bills are really terrible. So I don't want to downplay it, but it is a way of making those other pieces of legislation look less heinous.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about strategically. You know, when you conduct negotiations, you're always taught to anchor high or anchor low, have some offer that's very low. And then you essentially, you know, you can get a better, you know, you can drag the debate or the negotiation in your favor. And I think part of what's happening here is potentially, you know, the introduction of legislation that's so extreme that it makes what would otherwise be very heinous or very problematic seem more reasonable. You know, one thing that really caught my attention when you were speaking, Caroline, was when you were talking about certain types of contraception getting caught up in this. Can you help explain what their reasoning is regarding IUDs? I don't really understand why they're putting, you know, making that part of this discussion.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to explain too. I certainly can't understand. But you know, there's certain types of contraception works in different ways, and they would like to and have tried to equate certain methods of contraception with abortion as a way of, you know, further restricting women's access to reproductive care. You know, some of these you know, types of contraception are both really for women, low income women, can be very much more cost effective, and they're safe, and highly effective in terms of preventing pregnancy. So, what I think is it's just, you know, it's another really obscene effort to deny women access to very important care. So, you know, Renato, I can't really tell you exactly. I mean, there's no science, again, no science behind it. There are different ways that these contraceptions work. Some of them are hormonal, some of them are physical, you know, and so, and I am not a doctor, so I don't want to, you know, go into, you know, too much explanation, since I think you need somebody else on to do that. But it is, I think, you know, just another effort. It's a tactic, to make it harder for women to have reproductive care.
So I know you have to go soon. So I'm gonna ask you a couple of things fairly quickly. Well, one is there's been a very major shift in federal courts since Trump has taken office. He has only been in office for a couple of years, and he's appointed a very substantial number of federal judges. And I know that this is something that you are focused a lot on at ACS. So can you talk to us about the impact that that has on reproductive rights?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Yeah. Maybe your listeners will remember that one of the things Trump did when he was campaigning was he ran around with his list. You know, here are the people I'm going to appoint to the court, the federal courts. And, the major determinant of that list was, commitment to overturn Roe. So that has been the defining focus of his appointments, since he was elected. This is what got brought a lot of the kind of evangelical right-wing Christians into his camp, and why they continue to support him despite his lifestyle, his unethical and immoral behavior, his sexual harassment and assault. All of that, they can hold their nose because he's giving them judges that are committed to overturning Roe. And you've seen, there's a whole parade of people going who have been appointed. And since they've, done away with, any restraint on moving nominees, through the Senate, it's been a very fast pace. And it's really frightening, because it is a central tenet of his selection process. Leonard Leo with the Federalist Society, who helped put that list together, has been called by some of his best friends, as the one person, who they think is going to get Roe v. Wade overturned. It's his life's goal. And he's the guy who put Trump's list together. So, and I think we're unfortunately seeing the fruits of that now.
Yeah, I have to say, from when I was a young lawyer, even almost 20 years ago now, I was shocked by just how deeply felt amongst conservative legal elites the issue of overturning Roe is. I know Patty has one more thing, and then...
I just have one thing, because, Caroline, so many people, talk about how, elections have consequences, this is why you have to vote. But for many of us, that doesn't feel like enough right now. Do you have anything that people can really fundamentally do right now to be involved?
Well, I mean, there are lots of things. I mean, people really cannot just fall into despair. I mean, voting is actually really important. So I know the elections aren't coming up in a while, but organizing, getting involved with different organizations, like mine, the American Constitution Society, for lawyers or just people who care about fair courts that respect fundamental rights. We need good judges. We need to fight for them in the states. State court judges are incredibly important. They're elected in a lot of states in this country, but very few people pay attention to those elections. So pay attention. Get involved in the policy debates. Lobby your state legislature. People can't be passive, because that is why we lose. I think there are any number of ways that you can get involved. But look at what's happening in your state, because the more of a groundswell there is of more and more states that pass these kinds of really restrictive laws or outright ban Roe, the more likely it is the Supreme Court's going to say, hey, this is where the country is right now. And they'll take that case and they'll overturn Roe. So we cannot let that happen. There are states that are passing laws that actually protect women's access to abortion and explicitly protecting abortion. So, that's another avenue. Fight for good legislation where women actually have a full reproductive care, and we don't make abortion unavailable, even if it's not illegal.
I
just joined the ACS. Go ahead.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I will just say, and that's the perfect way to end this discussion, is about what we can do. There's tens of thousands of people listening to this, and really being alarmed is not enough. We all have to get off of our butts and do things. And I will just say that this is not a women's issue. It's really an issue of autonomy. It's an issue of freedom. And from my perspective, I'm on the board of an organization called Men for Choice. There are many organizations out there that men also can get involved in, and they can help aid this effort, because this shouldn't be something where only half the population is fighting for basic human freedoms. And I'm sure that the organizations, for example, like you were at NARAL, those organizations are organizations that men can also get involved with as well.
Absolutely. No, I mean, reproduction is, takes at least two parties. So, it should be equal responsibility, to care about, our reproductive rights in this country. So thanks for saying that. I totally agree. This is a human right for self-determination and autonomy. I appreciate you for saying that. And I really loved having this conversation.
Thank you, Caroline. Thank you for being on. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for all your work. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast, go to your app and review the podcast, and join us for our next episode. I'm Renato Mariotti. Until next time, let's stay on topic.